Acts 15 continued, the 56th talk in a series on the Book of Acts, was presented by Jack Crabtree on February 4, 2001, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2001. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle. This is the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side.
This is our third week in the 15th chapter of Acts. We'll try to finish it this week. We took a little detour last week and talked about the New Testament perspective on fornication, because we need to look at that this week in Acts 15. But before we do that, just brief review. The context of Acts 15, Antioch, which has been the center of one of the centers of Christian activity in the Eastern Mediterranean. That's the center that has reached out to the Gentiles, and Paul and Barnabas have been active teachers in that context. Paul has already taken his trip up into Galatia, has returned. When he returns, he finds that there's a fairly significant controversy brewing, and the controversy really comes down very simply to, can Gentiles be saved? Gentiles have believed in Jesus, and Paul has seen all kinds of evidence of the Spirit being poured out on Gentiles, just as they had been on the Jews on the day of Pentecost. And as we mentioned, the pouring out of the Spirit is an invisible reality unless God makes it visible with visible supernatural signs. So we have to assume that they knew that the Gentiles were receiving the Spirit because of the same supernatural signs that were experienced at Pentecost. Paul has seen numerous occasions where the Gentiles have received the Spirit in that sense. But there are a group of people, former Pharisees, who, although they have believed in Jesus, and although they have accepted the claim that Jesus is the Messiah, they don't really seem to get it. They don't really seem to understand what the gospel is all about. They have never really shed the Pharisaical self-righteousness and the kind of self-confidence that they can stand before God, acceptable to God, just on their own merits. They have really never grasped that. So they are coming from the perspective, and it's an understandable perspective, that salvation was for the Jews. And Gentiles are welcome in, but only by becoming Jews. That salvation is something that God is offering to Jews as Jews, so Gentiles need to become Jews in order to be saved. Paul is saying that's not what I've seen. I've seen Gentiles becoming favored by God quite independently of them ever becoming Jews. And there's this sharp dissension in Antioch as they debate this issue. They finally decide, we need to go down to the apostles and the elders at the church in Jerusalem and see what they have to say about this, because we're not coming to agreement here. And Acts 15 is about the meeting of Paul and Barnabas and some other representatives of the Antioch church who have come to the elders and the apostles in Jerusalem, and they deliberate this issue. The decisive factor, as I pointed out in past weeks, was the supernatural signs that accompanied the reception of the Spirit by the Gentiles. James, Peter, all of the apostles recognize, how can we, if God is saying yes, if God is saying amen to these Gentiles, who are we to say no? And the evidence is clear to them. You don't have to be a Jew to be saved. Even though that's contrary to one very reasonable way of reading the Old Testament scriptures, they recognize that God is taking things a different direction. We left off at about verse 13, where James is about to stand up and give his assessment of the situation. And as we will see, it's James' assessment of the situation that sort of wins the day. And they write a letter to the church at Antioch and in the churches in Galatia based on the things that that James says here. So verse 13, after they had stopped speaking, James answered, saying, "Brethren, listen to me. Simeon, that's Peter, has related how God first concerned himself about taking from among the Gentiles a people for his name. With this, the words of the prophets agree, just as it is written, "After these things I will return, and I will rebuild the tabernacle of David which has fallen, and I will rebuild its ruins, and I will restore it, so that the rest of mankind may seek the Lord, and all the Gentiles who are called by my name, says the Lord, who makes these things known from long ago. Therefore it is my judgment that we do not trouble those who are turning to God from among the Gentiles, but that we write to them that they abstain from things contaminated by idols, and from fornication, and from what is strangled, and from blood. For Moses from ancient generations has in every city those who preach him, since he is read in the synagogues every Sabbath." Then it seemed good to the apostles and the elders with the whole church to choose men from among them to send to Antioch with Paul and Barnabas, Judas called Barsabbas, and Silas, leading men among the brethren. And they sent this letter by them: "The apostles and the brethren who are elders to the brethren in Antioch and Syria and Cilicia, who are from the Gentiles, greetings. Since we have heard that some of our number to whom we gave no instruction have disturbed you with their words, unsettling your souls, it seems good to us, having become of one mind, to select men to send to you with our beloved Barnabas and Paul, men who have risked their lives for the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore we have sent Judas and Silas, who themselves will also report the same things by word of mouth. For it seems good to the Holy Spirit and to us to lay upon you no greater burden than these essentials, that you abstain from things sacrificed to idols, and from blood, and from things strangled, and from fornication. If you keep yourselves free from such things, you will do well. Farewell." Okay, so James stands up, and his initial response is to say, you know, it really shouldn't surprise us that there is such a category of people as Gentiles who are called by my name. And he quotes a prophetic passage out of Amos. And I think the only significance that James sees in this passage to this particular issue is that he has this line in here, "so that the rest of mankind may seek the Lord, even all the Gentiles who are called by my name." And James finds that significant because it's a clear and explicit reference to a class of people, Gentiles, who are called by my name. And he recognizes that that's in tension with the way we have tended to read the Old Testament. We have tended to read the Old Testament as if salvation is only and strictly for the Jews. And he says, then what do we do with this phrase? What do we do with this concept that Amos has, that there are Gentiles who are called by my name? If they are called by his name, shouldn't they be Jews? But these are Gentiles who are called by his name. I'm not sure I understand this passage in Amos. It does seem to be referring to something that is still in our future, the rebuilding of the temple. And interestingly, if that's true, if that's the way to read the passage, it's the rebuilding of the temple so that these Gentiles who are called by my name may seek the Lord. And I don't know what to do with that. I'm stuck. I just don't understand the passage. But James doesn't need us to understand the passage in order to make the point that he's making here. I think there's no more relevance than the fact that there's this class of people who are Gentiles called by his name. And James says, look, it's right there in the text. It's right there in the prophets. Amos is aware of a people who are not Jews, who are nonetheless the people of God. So that seems to be what Paul and Peter had experienced. When Peter went to Cornelius and the Spirit was poured out on Cornelius as a Roman before he ever became a Jew, I mean, he never did become a Jew, but without ever having become a Jew, the Spirit was poured out on Cornelius. That's what Peter was an eyewitness to. Paul has brought back report after report after report of Gentiles who have received Jesus. The Spirit has been poured out on them. They were Gentiles. They never became Jews. And yet, nonetheless, the Spirit was poured out on them. What are we going to do with that? It looks like those are the people that Amos was talking about. Or at least those are people in the class of the people that Amos was talking about. Gentiles who are called by his name. So he says, the prophets agree with all these reports that have been given to us. It is interesting. What we have seen every time the apostles are making a decision here, it's not their experience alone that is the basis upon which they know what the will of God is. It also is very important to them that it jibe with what the scriptures teach. I think it's not insignificant that what wins the day in this council is not merely the reports of Peter, not merely the reports of Paul, but James standing up and saying, and you know what? Actually, there is scriptural support for what these guys are reporting. There is a basis in scripture for thinking that that would be true. And at that point, that seems to resolve the issue. And they are of, as the letter says, they become of one mind. Okay, then this is for real. This is from God. God does, in fact, save Gentiles as Gentiles. But James does have a little disclaimer here. He says, that settles the issue that we're concerned about. Gentiles can be saved, not just Jews. But he says, therefore, it is my judgment that we do not trouble those who are turning to God from among the Gentiles. It's important that we understand that, first of all. James recognizes that if we do what the circumcision party wants, and that we come to the Gentiles and we say, you need to live like Jews, that we are what he calls troubling them, or as the letter puts it, we are burdening them. That there's no reason why Gentiles should have to eat funny and dress funny. There's no reason for that. That shouldn't be an obligation for Gentiles. It's the Jews who have a special burden, a special responsibility, but also a special destiny and a special reward, a special blessing. With the special reward comes a special burden, a special trouble that they have to organize their lives around these inconveniences of looking funny and eating funny. And James recognizes that and says to the this council, we don't need to lay that on the Gentiles. They're not us. They don't have our destiny. They don't have our privileges. They don't have this blessing that is in store for us and us alone. But then neither should they have the burden and the responsibility and the trouble and the inconvenience of guiding their lives by these rules and these principles. So my judgment is we leave them alone. Just let them be the people of God as Gentiles and let them not bother themselves with having to think like they have to live like Jews. Why? It's not their gig. It's ours. But, he says, that's his basic judgment. That's his basic fundamental decision. But he says, but that we write to them that they abstain from things contaminated by idols and from fornication and from what is strangled and from blood. And you'll notice that when they write the letter later, he says, for it seems good to the Holy Spirit and to us to lay upon you no greater burden, but notice he calls it a burden, something that's not necessary, something that is not a right and good thing for Gentiles to do, but something that goes above and beyond that and becomes a burden of sorts. No greater burden than these essentials, that you abstain from things sacrificed to idols and from blood and from things strangled and from fornication. And then James goes on to say, why? Why does it seem good that we place this burden on them? In 21, because for Moses from ancient generations has in every city those who preach him, since he is read in the synagogues every Sabbath. James is recognizing that in all these areas where this letter is being sent, there is a community of Jews, people who read Moses every week, who are instructed by the law of Moses every week. And I think it's just his way of describing Jews and people who identify with Jewish culture. Because there are these communities of Judaism in every culture, in every large city in the region that we're talking about, he's saying, It seems appropriate, it seems wise, it seems expedient that you Gentiles would be burdened by these things. Don't eat things contaminated by idols, and we'll talk more about that later, but basically what he's arguing is there are offerings, usually it's meat products of some kind, that have been offered to idols in the temple, and then they turn around them and sell them at the temple meat market. You can go and get your dinner at the temple meat market by buying this meat that has served its purposes religiously already, and now it's just there to be eaten, and they'll sell it to you. I don't know if it's at a discount or not, but maybe it's at a premium, I don't know, but we'll see in Corinth that that becomes a major issue. As believers, can we go to the temple meat market and buy our meat there, knowing as we do that this is meat that has been a part of a idolatrous practice, an idolatrous worship? Can we in good conscience do that? Some of the Corinthians are saying, sure, why not? To offer this meat to idols is to offer it to nothing. It doesn't, it's just meat, no big deal. Others are saying, no, this has been a part of pagan idolatry. We don't want to have anything to do with pagan idolatry. We can't eat such meat. And that's a controversy that Paul has to try to sort out. That's exactly, I think, what James is talking about here as well. He's saying, I don't want you to eat meat offered to idols. That's one of the things we're going to ask of you. But notice that he's calling it a burden. Notice that, and by calling it a burden, in effect what James is saying is, this is not fundamentally a moral issue. By all rights, you Gentiles ought to be perfectly free to eat meat that has been offered to idols. But given the scruples of Judaism, of Jewish culture as I know it, I'm telling you that it would not be good for the impact that your lives and your preaching proclamation of the gospel would have on these Jewish communities if you were to eat meat that's been offered to idols. So please don't do that. We're asking you to abstain from that. We'll come back to fornication in a second. And from what is strangled and from blood. That's not as clear, but some of the commentators I look at suggest, and I think quite reasonably, that in the Old Testament law, there are prohibitions against the eating of blood. And the reason that's given, I think it's in Leviticus, is because the life is in the blood. And I'm not fully sure I understand what that's all about. But for whatever reason, God has prescribed in the Mosaic law that blood not be a part of the diet of the Jews. And likewise, meat that has blood still in it should not be meat that is eaten by the Jews. And I think that's what they mean by things strangled, things that have not been fully drained of the blood. Now, why those things? I don't think we can know. If you look at your own culture, your own subculture, your own Christian background that you might have come out of, every sort of religious tradition has particular scruples that there's no real good explanation for why should that be such a big deal. Over all the things that are a big deal, why is this such an extraordinarily big deal? That if you knew that about a person, you would write them off in a second as an ungodly, unrighteous sinner. I don't know. You know, some things just for historical reasons, for emotional reasons, for cultural reasons of one kind or another, take on loom and importance in our minds. And all of us probably have certain personal values or religious values or moral values that we judge other people by. And if they violate that, then we know where they stand. You know, we know that they stand condemned because we'll tolerate a lot of sin and moral looseness, but not that. That is just completely unacceptable. And rather than speak for you, I'll let you use your imagination there, but there's probably something in your own mind that it's just inconceivable to you that a Christian, a disciple of Jesus, could do that. And I think what James is arguing is, as an observer of my own culture, as an observer of Judaism, I'm here to tell you that if you allow it to be part of your diet, that you eat blood, there's no way in the world that any Jew is going to let you get to first base in proclaiming the gospel to them. Because you're already discredited. You are obviously an ungodly, unrighteous, sinful man or woman if you eat blood. I mean, no civilized, decent, God-fearing human individual would eat blood. So if you do that, the Jews are going to write you off and you will have no hearing with them whatsoever. You completely negate and nullify any opportunity that you might otherwise have to proclaim the gospel to them. And we don't want you to do that. We love our people. We love our culture. We want our culture. We want the Jews to be saved. And we want you to be able to proclaim the gospel to them. And you're not going to be able to do it if you don't follow our advice here. because these things are going to close off any hearing that you would have from them. That's the context in which we need to understand this word fornication. Because the fourth condition, as he said, also you need to abstain from fornication. Okay, on the surface, that's really highly problematic, because if by fornication he means what we talked about last week, it is unthinkable that James or Paul or Peter or any of these people would say, well, let me burden you with this unnecessary regulation. Let me suggest that you be sexually pure rather than sexually impure. Not that you really have to be sexually pure, but, you know, just for the sake of the Jews, would you do that for us? That would be absurd, because that's clearly not their perspective about fornication everywhere else in the New Testament. So how do we understand what's going on here? I think there's two possibilities here. There's a famous German commentator on the relationship of the New Testament to the rabbinic literature that makes the point that one of the ways the word fornication is used in the rabbinic literature is to describe marriages between people that the rabbis say are inappropriate degrees, what they call degrees of marriage, inappropriate marriages. Different cultures allow different people to get married without considering it basically incestuous. Some cultures allow cousins to be married and they don't think anything of it. That seems totally morally appropriate. Other cultures, if cousins were to get married, they would consider it borderline incest, a kind of incestuous marriage. And one possibility here is that the Jews had a larger scope of taboo on who could get married than the Gentile world did. So one possibility is that what he's suggesting is, I know you, among you Gentiles, cousins can marry each other. I'm suggesting that might be a bad idea. Because within the Jewish culture, they're going to read that as sinful, ungodly incest. And you just, if you do that, you're going to lose all your hearing with the Jewish culture. That's one possibility. Ron suggested something the other day that just, you know, the light went on. I really think this is right, and I've looked for evidence of this, and I can't find direct evidence of this, but this makes more sense to me. And that is, it's entirely possible that the word fornication would be something that the Jews would also use to describe intermarriage between Jews and Gentiles. That seems entirely likely. There is a use of the word fornication in the prophets, when the prophets come to Israel, because Israel has established commercial relations with Tyre and Sidon and some of the other Philistine cities, the prophets accuse Israel of fornication. And undoubtedly it's because of the, along with commerce comes the exchange of religious ideas and spiritual ideas. And the Jews have been warned against that by God. Don't become like the other people. Don't become like the peoples, the ungodly peoples that surround you. And one sure fire way of becoming like them is to intermarry with them. And so there's constant prohibitions in Israel. Don't intermarry with the people in the Canaan. Stay apart. Stay a people distinctive. Keep your own culture, your own customs, your own the worship of your own gods, your own religion, because I am the true God and I'm making a covenant with you to be your God and you will be my people. And that's going to break down and that's going to be violated if you bring wives into your homes that bring their gods with them. So don't do that. And the word that's used is fornication to describe that spiritual contamination. Undoubtedly, whether they are rightly construing it or wrong, whether they are really understanding what God is after or not, undoubtedly, given the pattern of rabbinic interpretation, it seems highly likely that they would have said the same thing in the time of Paul about any Jewish intermarriage with any Gentile. Rabbis would have lost sight of the context entirely, and that wouldn't make any difference to them. There's just the law. Jews don't marry Gentiles, period. And although I didn't find any direct evidence of the use of the word fornication to describe that, that seems highly likely that that's exactly the word that they would have used to describe it. If that's the case, then I'm even more inclined to think that that's what he's talking about, rather than the degree of marriage thing. Because that would be obviously a very immediate and direct problem. You've got Jew and Gentile coming together in the same community now. We are believers in Jesus, and we are coming together, and we are fellowshipping together. We are being instructed together. We are loving one another, caring for one another. We are socializing together, and a very natural, logical result from that would be some Jewish man catching the fancy of some Gentile young woman, or the other way around. That's very likely. Are they going to marry? And what James is saying is, it's going to be a problem. If that happens, you are going to so alienate yourself from the non-believing Jewish community that you have effectively shut down any lines of communication between you. So we're asking you, it's not that there's anything wrong with Jew marrying Gentile. This is a burden. This is not a moral issue. But strategically, it would be deadly to the hopes of our people hearing the gospel. So please, we ask you, would you take on this burden and abstain from marrying our Jewish daughters or sons? One of those two would make sense, and the latter makes more sense even. But that's what James is talking about. These are things that are not moral issues, but unnecessarily burdensome requirements that they're asking these churches to abide by. Okay, let me talk a little bit about a problem that I see here. When you turn to 1 Corinthians, and I won't bother to go there, but it basically the argument goes from chapter 8 through chapter 10 of 1 Corinthians, with a significant section in the middle there being kind of a detour. But the first part of chapter 8 and the last part of chapter 10 is Paul addressing the issue of meat that's been bought at the meat market at the temple that's been offered to idols. And he's addressing the question of how should the Corinthians handle that. And there appear to be two different viewpoints. There are those Corinthian believers who are enlightened, and they understand their freedom in Jesus. They understand that idols don't exist. I mean, there is no real God that is being worshipped when meat is offered to an idol. And in their enlightened understanding of things, they feel perfectly free to eat any old meat they want to anytime, and it's not an issue. But there are other Corinthians who have real hesitation, real scruples about eating meat that's been offered to idols. And they're not exactly seeing eye to eye. And they're undoubtedly the enlightened class of Corinthian believers is looking contemptuously down on the unenlightened fools that the other people are. And those who have the scruples are looking at the so-called enlightened Corinthian believers and basically condemning them, looking at them with condemnation. They are evil, ungodly, disobedient, idolatrous believers, and how can they even be Christians at all? How can they be genuine disciples? So there's this conflict, and Paul is speaking into that context. To make a long story short, I mean, there's a whole lot we could say about that, but the bottom line of Paul's advice to the Corinthians is that he sides with the enlightened side theologically. He worries more about them spiritually. And what I mean by that is they are so arrogant in their freedom that he worries that their arrogance is a sign of the inauthenticity of their spirituality, the inauthenticity of their discipleship. So he's really genuinely worried about that. You know, you say you're free to eat this meat, But you are so inflexible and unbending and unloving in the way that you're going about doing it, I wonder if you aren't really idolaters. I mean, I'm not sure that you've really come to terms with what it means to be a disciple of Jesus if you don't understand that being a disciple of Jesus is to look out for the interests of others above the interests of yourself. And so maybe you need to forego eating this meat that you are free to eat for the sake of your brother. And if you see no compunction to do that, then what kind of disciple are you? Because isn't that what Jesus did? Didn't Jesus set aside his rights and privileges for our sake? Didn't he, like, die for you, for example? If we're going to be disciple of him, we ought to be sacrificial in the same way that he is and have that kind of love in our hearts. So he's worried about them morally and spiritually. But he agrees with them theologically. With respect to the idols, idols are nothing. Just dumb stone shapes. No reality behind it. We all know that. Yes, absolutely. Strictly speaking, we all ought to be free to eat meat offered to idols. I agree with that. So the bottom line in his advice when you get to the end of chapter 10 is, look, if you go to a party and somebody slaps down a steak in front of you, don't ask where it came from. Just eat the stupid thing. Just eat it. Don't worry about it. Exercise freedom. You're not being contaminated if it happens to be meat that's been offered to idols. It's not going to contaminate you. Don't worry about it. Just eat it. But he says, if someone comes up to you and with concern for your spiritual well-being says, oh, I wouldn't eat that if I were you. That's been offered to idols. Then he says, then don't eat it. For conscience sake, he says, but not your conscience, because your conscience is free, your conscience is clear, but for his conscience sake, don't eat it. And then he talks about, because you might make your brother stumble. And I think it's becoming clearer to me as I look at it, what he has in mind here. He has in mind a person perhaps who has actually been a pagan idolater for most of their life, and they have practiced the ritual practices of paganism, and the meat offered to idols was a part of that, was just a part of the culture, was just a part of that whole religious system. They have become a believer and have presumably repudiated that, but they have a certain perception of what that's all about. And part of for them to eat meat offered to idols would be actually very easy. They have never had scruples against that their whole life. It would be very easy for them to eat meat offered to idols because that's what they've been doing their whole life. They're very comfortable with that as a practice. But in their newfound faith, they've decided to repudiate that. The last thing you want to do, Paul is saying, is by your example, suggest to them, oh, we can be a disciple of Jesus and eat meat offered to idols. That's okay. Now, why, he says? Because your eating that meat offered to idols is one thing. That weaker brother, he calls it the weaker brother, that weaker brother's eating the meat offered to idols is an entirely different thing. Because if his perception has not been transformed, if it has not been changed, if he hasn't come to have the same outlook on life that you do, namely, idols are a fiction, are a myth, are out of touch with reality, they have no grounding in the reality of how things are. If his freedom doesn't come from there, then his freedom is going to come from, oh, I guess you can mix a little idolatry with your discipleship with Jesus. And Paul is saying, that ain't so. That would be a huge mistake. That would be sending a very destructive and a very damaging message to him if you were to induce him to follow your example, and in doing so, inducing him to do something that is in his own perception of things would be fundamentally idolatrous. He would be violating his own conscience, and you would be inducing him to violate his conscience, and we don't want to do that. That's not helpful to anybody. So for love's sake, for love of the weaker brother's sake, until he gets up to speed and understands what you understand, would you be loving enough to sacrifice that nice dinner in front of you for the sake of not inducing him to violate his conscience? And Paul is saying, that's what you need to do. That's what love demands. That's what our Lord would demand. Okay, that's what he says. But notice how on the surface, at least, it looks like radically different advice than the advice James is giving. James says, we want you, as a lifestyle, to not eat meat offered to idols. Paul says, I want you as a lifestyle to eat meat offered to idols and not worry about it, unless somebody makes an issue out of it. You know, a lot of scholars look at that and say, see, Paul and James are in tension with each other. They're at war with one another. There's this political battle about whose ideas are going to win out. There's the conservative views of James, and there's the more liberal views of Paul. And Paul plays along as long as it's in his best interest at the Council of Jerusalem, but get him away from there on his own at Corinth, and he gives him entirely different advice. Is that how we're to read this? No, I don't think so. I think that's a mistake. We lose sight of the fact that many of these things that we are reading about in the New Testament are situational in nature. They're addressing a particular time and place in history with its own peculiar features, its own peculiar problems, and they're addressing those peculiar problems. There really is no question that Galatia is an entirely different cat from current Corinth. Corinth is a Roman city. It's a cosmopolitan city. It's a very licentious city, a very morally permissive city. It's the California of its day. It's this incredibly eclectic, loose, cosmopolitan city. I don't know ultimately the answers as to why Paul takes the different slant that he does, but it stands to reason that it is rooted in a different assessment of the different problems in the different cultures. Syria and Cilicia are one culture. Corinth is another culture. What's a problem in Syria and Cilicia for the Jewish communities there may not be nearly the same problem to the same degree to the Jewish community in Corinth. Paul is addressing people in Corinth as to what they should be doing. James is addressing the Gentiles in Syria and Cilicia as to what they should be doing. We're also talking about a lapse of time. It partly stands to reason that at the time that James is giving this advice and that this letter in Acts 15 is written, that they have not altogether become convinced that the Jews are unwilling to give the gospel a hearing. It's entirely possible, but by the time that Paul is writing the letter to Corinth, that Paul is utterly convinced that not eating meat offered to idols is not going to get you any closer to getting a hearing from the Jews than if you don't. That they've become convinced that the working of God in history is such that God is not going to pour out his Spirit to open the eyes and open the ears of the Jews at this time. And they've decided to just not make that an issue. That's also entirely possible because we've had enough time pass between Acts 15 and the letter of the Corinthians that they're assessing a very different situation. James and Peter are still, they've lived in an environment in Jerusalem where they have had a response of some sort, some measure of response among the Jews to the gospel. They have never been to the Gentile world. They have never confronted the Jewish communities out there in the diaspora. They have not seen what Paul has seen. They don't realize how blinded, how stubborn, how hard-hearted the Jewish communities by and large are to the gospel. Paul has already seen that, and after another 10 years or so, he's seen it happen for 10 years. And so it's understandable if in Corinth, it doesn't even really register with Paul to be an issue any longer. Because the Jews have already written the gospel off. What's the point? So these are significantly different situations, and I think it's unfair for us to not take into account the situational nature of the letter in Acts 15 as opposed to the situation of the letter to the Corinthians. There's one other passage in the New Testament that deals with similar issues, and that's Romans 14. Romans 14 actually... Notice therefore that 1 Corinthians is also addressing a different problem than Acts is. The problem that James is addressing in Acts is there's a whole unbelieving Jewish community out there. Are we or are we not going to be able to proclaim the gospel to them and get a hearing? That's the issue he's concerned about. The issue that Paul is concerned about is among believers, is between believers. What about the relation? What is the impact of my life on a fellow believer when we believers don't always have not always arrived at the same understanding? We don't always see exactly the same way on certain moral issues or social issues. What do I do to think about my impact on what he calls the weaker brother? And there he's concerned about the actual impact of me setting an example that might induce somebody to follow when they're not ready theologically to follow, when their understanding is not up to speed to be able to do that. In Romans 14, he addresses that problem, the same problem that he addresses 1 Corinthians, and he adds another one to it. And that problem is not, what about my example inducing a weaker brother to follow my example to his own destruction? But how are we going to get along with each other as believers when we don't see eye to eye on some issue? And the first part of Romans 14 is devoted to saying, those of you who are more enlightened, don't hold in contempt those people who are less enlightened. Rather, consider, and he takes things like practicing a holiday, somebody that feels obligated to celebrate a festival or something like that. He says, we know that we are free to not keep the Sabbath or to not keep a festival. We know that that's neither here nor there, ultimately, in our standing before God. But your brother doesn't know that. When he celebrates that festival or when he keeps that Sabbath, what is he doing? He's seeking to honor God, he's seeking to obey God, and he's seeking to express his gratitude toward God. Is that like a bad thing or is that a good thing? He says, that's a great thing. I mean, give him a break. He may not know what you know in terms of the freedom that you have, but his heart is perfect. His heart is exactly where it needs to be. In the context of his own understanding, he's seeking to honor, obey, and show gratitude to God, and that's exactly where we want to be. And then he turns to the person who feels this unnecessary religious obligation, this religious obligation that we, by all rights, would know is not really an obligation. And he says, don't judge the brother who doesn't feel that same obligation, who doesn't practice all those religious practices that you're practicing, who doesn't keep the dietary laws the same way you do and so on. Don't condemn him. Ask yourself the question, as you look at that person's life, do they love God? Are they seeking to trust God? Are they seeking to obey God? Do they express gratitude toward God? If all that stuff is true of their hearts, then never mind their transgressions. And you object, but they're transgressing. I mean, but they're being disobedient. Well, maybe. Paul doesn't think so, but maybe, okay, maybe they're transgressing. But do you think maybe God's big enough to the task of teaching them? Do you think maybe God is big enough to the task to instruct them in such a way that in time they will grow and they will learn and they will begin to practice what God wants them to practice, if you're right? And basically his underlying stance in that is, it's to our master that we stand or fall, and stand we will, he says, for God is able to make us stand. In other words, he's taking the perspective that we are all in progress. None of us are doing it right. None of us have everything figured out. None of us understand everything perfectly. None of us do everything exactly the way a true disciple of Jesus really ought to do it. None of us are there. So we need to cut one another slack and recognize that I'm not their Lord. I'm not their master. I'm not their judge. There is one who is their judge, and he is a judge who loves them enough that he's going to make them with contempt. But again, that's not Acts 15. That's a different issue. The issue he's arriving at there is, between fellow believers, how are we going to have the kind of mutual love and respect that is appropriate for believers when we can't agree exactly on all the relevant issues? How are we? What kind of attitude is going to keep us from holding one another in contempt and judging one another? That's the issue there. But the issue that James is talking about is, how are we going to keep a door open to the unbelieving Gentile community? How can we make sure that we don't so outrage them that we lose our voice with them and lose a hearing with them. Different question, different issue. And so he gives a different, slightly different response and a slightly different solution. So it's crucial to understand exactly what the issue is and exactly what the reasoning is behind the advice. And I think when we do that, what we find in the end is it's very coherent. These people are looking at this exactly the same kind of way. Paul in 1 Corinthians 9 says exactly the same thing that James is saying in Acts 15. Right smack dab in the middle of that section about eating meat offered to idols, where he says in the end, feel free to eat it, but not if someone comes up and says, you don't want to do that. But in the middle of that, in his detour, he says, so that I might win some, I become all things to all men. To those who are under the law, I become as under the law. To those who are without the law, I become as without the law. To those who are weak, I become as weak. Can't remember what else he says. But the basic spirit behind what he's saying is exactly what is behind what James is saying. We want to win anybody that we can win. This gospel is too important to allow a human being who might respond to it to be put off just because I'm so selfish and stubborn that I'm not willing to sacrifice something. And so Paul says, I sacrifice all over the place. I sacrifice whenever I have an opportunity to sacrifice, if that might win somebody, if that might make the difference in whether they will hear me or not. So in 1 Corinthians 9, he's saying exactly what James is saying, but that's a different issue. The issue in 1 Corinthians 10 is, what about the impact of my life on a weaker brother? Different question and a different response. Questions, comments, objections? Was it that bad?
I think with the blood issue that they may be considering the Noahic covenant as part of their objection. The strong language that God relates eating blood and I will require your blood, mm-hmm. and so on. And then also I think particularly with Aryan and Semitic cultures, which I'm sure the Jews are very familiar, blood was a very important, and the shedding of, well, the killing of animals. So it was very important. And, you know, later one of the religions that they were in direct conflict with was Mithraism, mm-hmm. which the shedding of blood of the bull and this whole type of initiation.
Is that the Tarabulian?
Yeah. Was very, very important in the culture, this type of shedding blood. In fact, one of the pictures with Mithraism is with the shedding of blood, there's actually wheat coming out from the blood.
There's what coming out?
Wheat.
Wheat?
Coming out of the bull's body. And so this type of fertility and so on also was tied in with the blood. And I think that may be one of the reasons why they may have, quote...
So once again, a tie-in with idolatry?
Yeah, right. Okay. Because to me, I mean, I don't know, I am a student of ancient history, and this is something that is very prevalent, especially in the ancient histories, is blood, how important the shedding of blood is in atonement and fertility and mm-hmm. so on. So I think that's my understanding. Because it was so tied in with paganism that they chose to put that burden on.
Great, that's helpful. I there isn't much information out there about this, so I wasn't sure what to do with that. But thank you.
So am I hearing you say that James's concern is to not create a stumbling block for the Jews in this process?
Yes, but don't, in 1 Corinthians, the word stumbling block is used.
Yeah, no, I'm...
Yeah, and that he means something different in 1 Corinthians.
Right.
But yeah, in probably in our idiom, to not be a stumbling block, not be an obstacle.
So given that context or that concern, why would it not be that he would encourage them to do the thing that's going to be the biggest stumbling block, and that is circumcision.
Yeah, good question. I wondered about that, and I don't know the answer unless again, situationally, that's become the hot topic in the debate between them, and that to demand that might be construed as a capitulation to the theology behind the circumcision party, and that that's what they've decided. No, that's not right. You know, that's not the truth. That would be to compromise the truth. So we need to...
That's crossing the line.
Yeah, crossing the line. I'm just speculating there. I'm not sure, but that would make sense to me.
On the prohibition of fornication, any connection with the pagan temples using various sexual impurity in their rites? Is there a connection there, possibly?
Well, even there, though, it's hard to know why he would call that a burden, because if it's actual fornication in the temple, we saw what he did with that last week, that was just wrong. I mean, it's just immoral. And if it's anything that involves idolatry, real, genuine idolatry, that would be wrong as well. So it's possible that there's something that could just be not morally wrong, but by association. But I don't know if that well, I don't know. I think that's possible, but I don't know what that would be. I don't know concretely what practice they'd be referring to then. But something like that's possible.
Just a couple of observations. One is we can look at these things as actions that we're supposed to do or not do. And what you keep coming back to, and I'm saying it in part to remind myself, is the actions come out of the heart.
Yeah.
And it kind of just looks like a bunch of rules here, but I think what you're saying is that's what's important. That's what's the most important. And I was thinking about my own attitude toward people who are doing things that look very necessary to them, but very an immature perspective in my eyes. And it's good to be reminded that maybe it's a very mature response that they're having, not their actions, but the fact that they want to pursue God with such passion.
Mm-hmm.
And they might do it in a way that doesn't make sense to me at all. Now, it's not necessarily that their actions are representative of a heart toward God, but I don't think I can determine that, and they might be. It might be, so I need to leave it at that. Would you say so?
Yeah, exactly. There is an important balance. I mean, we also see, as we saw a couple weeks ago, I mean, when Paul writes Romans and Galatians, he's peering into the heart of these Pharisees, the circumcision party, and he's discerning that there's something fundamentally amiss about their understanding of where they stand with God. They are self-deceived. So I don't think it would be just as wrong to take the perspective, it doesn't really make any difference what Christians practice, as long as they're trying to love Jesus, just get off their back. Well, no, not if they're self-deceived. And so on the other hand, we need to make sure that we're not so undiscerning, so welcoming, so all-inclusive, that we fail to be discerning about why are you doing this? What lies behind it? What's going on here? So in Romans 14, his whole argument is assuming that the so-called weaker brother, or the one with the weaker conscience, is just simply not quite up to speed on how reality works. But the heart is honest, transparent, meek, and humble before God, and is basically the heart of a believer. But there are people who are highly religious, highly scrupled, and the reason they're highly religious with all kinds of religious and moral scruples is precisely because it's part of their self-deception. And to those people, we owe nothing but to destroy their self-deception. Love would say to them, you whited sepulchre full of dead men's bones, you have to look at yourself. You won't get anywhere with God until you take a look at yourself. But it takes, you know, we need to be discerning to know the difference. But I think if we don't know the difference, we just charitably assume the best for people, I think.
I don't have to do this. We can just leave if you want. But this is totally, in a sense, off the topic. It's in Acts, but I was realizing when you started out that I've been thinking back over what you said, and I couldn't remember what you said about the very last part of Peter's the sermon, the little comment that Peter makes before you get to the James thing, where he talks about the yoke that we were unable to bear. Why would we want to put this yoke on them?
Mm-hmm.
Did you talk about that?
I didn't. And I need to think about that some more. I'm not exactly sure. Where I lean is toward simply just the covenant itself, that he's looking at the covenant as a whole, and he's recognizing the kind of thing I was saying at the beginning of this morning, that we have a distinctive destiny, we have a distinctive place, and we have this distinctive responsibilities and obligations that go with that, and that whole distinctive responsibilities and things that go with that is this yoke that they bear that has not been given to the Gentiles to bear. And when he says that we have been able to bear it, what he means is we've never kept the covenant, and we're going to turn around now and say, but you Gentiles have to do it in order to be saved. That doesn't make any sense. We have been saved even though our people have not kept the covenant. You know, James, Peter, Paul, we are saved, but our people have never kept the covenant. We're turning to the Gentiles and saying, you can't be saved unless you keep the covenant. That doesn't make any sense. That's where I lean. But I need to think about that some more. Remember when it was really striking when Rabbi Lapin came to a conference a few years ago, he used exactly that language. Exactly that language. I can't get it verbatim, but the gist of what he said was, I recognize that we have to live lives of inconvenience because we're Jews. It's a burden that God has placed upon us. And it was very striking when he said that, because this passage came to mind, that he recognizes that's our gig. That's something that God is asking us to do. But with it comes a real privilege. The only people on earth that will ever be the people of God. But with it comes the burden of having to do the weird things that God has asked them to do. I think that's the yoke. Okay.